Jayakrishna was supposed to have a practice this afternoon for the Colors Festival, and the guitarist didn't show up, so he's got all this energy, and he's in the mood, But thank you very much for that. This will be the third and concluding part of a series called Controlling Your Reactions. And the first two times, we suggested that if you fall in any of these categories, you need to hear not only this segment, but go back and download from the website the first two segments as well. So you can stop overreacting. Happy are those people who do not overreact to people. If you forget, if you regret things that you say or do in the heat of emotion, this is for you. If you lash out at loved ones, this is for you. If you feel surprised at your overreactions and uncontrollable emotions in the heat of an argument, this is for you. And if you withdraw when things get emotionally overwhelming, this talk is for you. There are five areas in which we pointed out that people are most likely to overreact. People are most likely to overreact when there are people who are not serving them according to their expectations. And when that happens, when people are serving you, you need to learn to be understanding and not demanding. Another area in which we commonly overreact is when people disappoint us. When that happens, we need to learn to be gentle, but not judgmental. And then as well, when there are disagreements, we need to be tender without surrender. And the last area is that when someone corrects us, we need to be teachable and not unreachable. So we'll talk about this and conclude today this series about how not to overreact. We talked originally about meekness. In our society, to be called meek is kind of an insult. A wife asks her husband, she says, "Are you a man or a mouse? Squeak up." So it's generally not considered complimentary when someone calls you meek. But in our context, meekness means strength which is under control. If you can't control your strength, if you can't control your emotions, that in itself is the worst kind of weakness. And it is said later on in this slideshow that those who can control their emotions, they're greater than those who can conquer great cities. Because anyone can conquer great cities, but how many people can control their anger or their overreaction? So meek people, which means to say people whose strength is under control, they're eager to learn. They don't pretend that they know it all. Last week we said you have to be very, very careful about people who know it all. And in fact, we're going to go right ahead here together to this one here. In fact, this is the last one, and this is the one we're going to talk about today. When someone hurts you, be an actor and not a reactor. Surviving Friendly Fire is the name of a popular best-selling book. It's subtitled, How to Respond When You're Hurt by Someone You Trust. Most of the things to which we overreact, most of the hurts, in fact, most of the crimes in countries all over the world are perpetrated by people who know each other. And the worst crimes are perpetrated by people that know each other very, 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 very well. So what do you do when someone hurts you? Well, someone says, well, I just try and avoid it. I just try and not be hurt, live my life in such a way as not be hurt. But that's not possible. You're going to be hurt. And someone's going to hurt you. And not only are you going to be hurt, not only is someone going to hurt you, but it's likely that's going to be someone very close to you. Because if a stranger hurts you, how deeply does it cut you? How deeply does it affect you? Hurt, really deep, deep lasting hurts that are hard to let go of, that we dwell on even 10, 20 years later, those are the ones that are inflicted by people that know us. So you will have hurts in life. Life itself is full of hurts. Birth, death, disease, and old age, hunger, thirst, lamentation. These are all hurts. Other people often hurt us unintentionally sometimes, and sometimes they hurt us intentionally. So the question for someone who's trying to control their strength and not let their emotions get out of control is, how does a meek person deal with the hurts which are inevitably going to come in life? What will be the source of our strength? Now, there's two terms here. There's meekness of weakness, and there's weakness of bleakness. Now, a lot of people may not react because they're suffering what we call the weakness of bleakness. They don't have a purpose in life. They don't have a goal. They don't have a direction in which they're going. They feel themselves weak and helpless, and the future looks bleak. And so they say, what's the point? And they lie down and let people walk all over them. They act as other people's doormat. So that's the weakness of bleakness. Now, the meekness of weakness is recognizing the limits of your own strength. There are times when even the strongest of us, even the ones of us who have the greatest fortitude and the greatest determination, we reach a point where we just want to bail. I can't take it anymore. That's it. Where's the life raft? That's the point at which we need to access a higher strength than our own strength is available. Even Prabhupada, when he came to America for the first year, in his efforts to establish the Krishna conscious movement, there was not much success. He was living from here to there, from hand to mouth. Even one time he was attacked by a hippie with whom he was living, who had taken LSD and was chasing him with a knife. So Prabhupada would go to the Boston Harbor, which is where the ship had deposited him from India 1 year prior to that. And we'd look at the ships leaving for India. Perhaps at those moments, kids will have to be quiet. At those moments, perhaps Prabhupada might have thought, just entertain, maybe peripherally, the thought of bailing. Wouldn't it be nice in some ways to get on the ship and just go back and write America off, because it didn't seem like anything was happening. But Krishna was working behind the scenes. Krishna had a plan. And Prabhupada accessed that higher power. And that's what we call the meekness of weakness. Going as far as you can take it, and then when you can't take it any further, when you think of bailing, then you plug in to the higher power of God. Attribution. And doing that, you know, the problem is that theoretically, we all would recognize, at least theoretically, that God has power. We would all recognize. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that God has hypothetical power. And maybe someday, some way, somehow or other, he could maybe be a factor in my life. But the attribution principle is to realize that God's power is working here and now, and in fact at all times. That we need to ascribe all power to him at all times. Even if that power is misdirected, the power actually comes from him. In this slide here on the right-hand side, you have Prahlad Maharaj, who was a great devotee of Krishna, lived tens of thousands of years ago. And his father was a huge, powerful demoniac personality. Prahlad's habit was chanting, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, which his demoniac father could not stand. Finally, it came to the point his father tried to kill him. Unsuccessfully, this big was throwing his son over a cliff, putting him in a pit with poisonous cobras, depositing him under the foot of a war elephant, and none of these efforts to kill Prahlad succeeded. And finally, being frustrated, Hiranyakashipu towered over his five-year-old son, and he said, where do you get your power from? Prahlad said something very, very appropriate. He said, I get my power from the same place that you get your power from. In other words, all that power, that demoniac power and energy which Hiranyakashipu had used to tyrannize and subdue the whole universe, that power had come from God. It was just misused. It was misdirected. But nobody does anything except it's by the power of God. We're sitting here. The kids are chatting in the corner. His foot is going up and down. All these things are happening because God allows it to go on. He's actually the power in us that sanctions even the gesture of my hand or my speech. So it's not that God is some otherworldly or some hypothetical power which might or might not be invoked at some point in time. Every power, every exhibition of power and energy actually comes from God. So we need to learn to see the power as as active power rather than as potential power. We need to think of God's power not as something potential, but as something that is active here and now. In physics, this is called latent or kinetic. Rather than seeing God's power as latent, sort of in abeyance or off on the side, like a substitute that we might need to bring in on fourth down, we need to see God's power as what took us to first, second, third, and fourth down in the first place. We need to see it as kinetic power. And it's interesting because when Prahlad Maharaj told his father that I get my power from the same place you get your power from, then Hiranyakashipu said, so where is your God? Where is this powerful source of all of our energies? And Prahlad says, he's everywhere and he's active at all times. Then Hiranyakashipu, they were standing on the porch of the house and there was a big pillar. Like this is also called as a stamba or a pillar. And Hiranyakashipu said, well, is your God in this pillar? And Prahlad says, yeah, he's not off somewhere, separate. He's inside of each and every atom. Like electricity is within everything. So then he said, is he in this pillar? And Prahlad said, yeah. And so when Hiranyakashipu went with his sword to strike that pillar, look at what came out. Narasimha Dev, the ferocious half man, half lion, incarnation of the Lord. And it wasn't like he just took a quick train, you know, and crouched in the pillar and came out at that moment. He is within each and every atom, fully present, fully potent at each and every moment. He just came out to protect his pure devotee. Yes. All right, good. So when we reach the limits of our power, these are some good meditations to help us to go the extra mile. He never wearies or weakens. I always do. He never surrenders or compromises. I always do. He never murmurs or complains. I usually do. In spite of our series, three-part series, How to Conquer Complaining. He never lets up or lets go. He never surrenders. I always do. He endures. He perseveres. He overcomes with a smile. If you're familiar with the scene of the Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna was faced with a huge opposing army, over 3 million soldiers, all of whom were intent on killing him. Some of them were his teachers, his cousins, his brothers. And Arjuna was not smiling. He was not smiling. And he couldn't see himself using lethal force against some of his teachers and his seniors. If you can imagine the way society was thousands and thousands of years ago, you never spoke harshly to your superiors, to your elders, to your teachers. You virtually worshiped them as gurus. And here Arjuna couldn't see himself trying to shoot with arrows and lethal, deadly intent people like Bhisma and Dronacharya, who had been his teachers and his gurus and for whom he had genuine affection aside from the social protocol. So he was really, really paralyzed, really unhappy. He didn't know he couldn't see himself going fighting. He couldn't see himself not fighting. It was between a rock and a hard spot in a way that perhaps nobody was ever in a situation like that in the history of the world. And he turns to Krishna. And Krishna's smiling. Krishna's smiling. He says, so this is a pretty big thing for you, Arjuna? So this is like in over your head, huh? Well, how would you like to bring it to Papa now? How would you like to lay it before the Lord of the universe? My specialty is solving problems. Problems which from your tiny, tiny perspective look huge and insurmountable. From my perspective, they're nothing. They are my specialty. Those things which you cannot handle, which overcome you, those are nothing for me. With a smile. Our normal behavior pattern is not to have a forethought, not to stop, not to access the higher power, the knowledge. Our normal reaction to a hurt is reflexive. All those words that we use, response, react, revenge, retaliate, they all start with R-E, which means you didn't think about it. You let yourself go. You overreacted. You lost control like any animal on the street. If we're to be truly human beings and mature in spiritual life, we need to not to go to the re right away and all the time. We need to be proactive and not reactive. Here's a couple of instances from the Mahabharata. When the Pandavas built a palace by the help of Maya Dhanava, they had an opening day, and this was a magical, mystical palace, the likes of which had never been built before. And Duryodhana, the evil-minded Duryodhana, was already completely envious of the Pandavas, that they got a better palace than he had. He'd already arranged to banish them into this Kandava desert area, and he took over the beautiful pre-existing palaces in Hastinapur. He banished the Pandavas out into this desert area. And lo and behold, because of their accessing the power of Krishna, they developed a better kingdom and more love from their subjects than Duryodhana ever could have. And in the course of this, they built a parliament hall, like a capital building. So the opening day came, and Duryodhana was touring it, and he came to an area that looked like it was water. So he lifted up his dhoti and he started tiptoeing across. But it was an illusion. It looked like water, but it was really land. So here he was in the middle of solid land with his dhoti hucked up around his knees, and all the ladies on the balcony were going, silly Duryodhana. And especially Draupadi, for whom he had had a crush since he was a child. She was the common wife of the Pandavas. So he just burned. He just burned with envy. He wanted to retaliate. He wanted to react. And then later on, as he was touring the palace, he came to an area that looked like dry land. And he just walked through it, and then he went, and he got soaking wet. And then again, the ladies, good job, dude. Double header. Huh? Yeah. And then he just burned, and he was going to get back at them no matter what. And later on, after the Pandavas had finished 13 years of exile, the pre-arrangement was that when they came back, they would get their kingdom back. Duryodhana refused to give them their kingdom back because he couldn't let go of that incident that had happened 13 years ago. He had allowed that incident to control his whole behavior pattern. He said, not only will I not give the Pandavas back their kingdom as I had promised, but I will not give them as much land as will fit on the head of a pin. In other words, he wanted war. He wanted war. He didn't consider or entertain any other alternative because he was simply reacting and living in the past and allowing that incident to tie him up. When you react, we said last week, when you react, you get a reaction. When you don't react, you don't get a reaction. We talked about action and inaction and inaction and action. Now here's Draupadi, that same Draupadi who sort of tittered at Duryodhana. Later on, after the war had finished, there were about 5,000 Pandavas who survived the battle, and there were only 3 Kauravas who had survived on Duryodhana's side. So the war was over, and those 5,000 soldiers were exhausted from 18 days of fighting, and they were sleeping the sleep of death in a tent. Now those 3 survivors of the Kauravas, they also overreacted, and they went into that tent, and they slaughtered all those soldiers while they were sleeping. They slaughtered all. In those days, you only fought an opponent who was facing you in battle. If the opponent had lost his weapons, you would not fight him. If the opponent surrendered, you would show mercy. So they overstepped all those rules of etiquette and went in and slaughtered sleeping soldiers, among whom were the 5 teenage sons of Draupadi. And when the news reached their fathers, Bhishma and Arjuna, Nakula, Sahadeva, and Yudhishthira, especially Bhima, he wanted revenge. He wanted to capture those perpetrators, those murderers, and he wanted to kill them. And the chief amongst them was a fellow named Ashwatthama. So they went after him, they caught him, and here you see is Bhishma with the big strong guy with the sword, and there's Draupadi, and it's her. Bhima lost one son. Of the five, one of them was Bhima's. All five sons were Draupadi's. All five sons of hers were slaughtered. Bhima wants to kill Ashwatthama, and Draupadi is pleading, please don't kill him. Please don't kill him. She was sensitive to the pain of a mother who's lost a child. She just lost five children, and she didn't want Ashwatthama's mother to experience the same pain that she did. So she reined herself in from reacting, and thus she did not incur any karmic action from that. Whatever impetus of action and reaction and aggression and retaliation had been set in motion, it ended with her. Gandhi, he said, an eye for an eye makes the whole world blind. So when something comes to you, a reaction, are you going to just pass it on unthinkingly, reflexively, or are you going to say, no, it stops with me. I'm going to show grace. I'm going to show forgiveness. Unlike everyone else, I'm not going to react. I'm not going to retaliate. I'm not going to seek for revenge. We do this not on our own strength, but realizing the nature of God. How much God puts up with us. How many times we deserve to have been killed, or we deserve to have been punished for all of our transgressions, for all the pain and suffering that we've caused other living beings, human and subhuman. How much should we deserve to be thumped? And yet God shows unlimited patience for us. Because of who He is, He endures our rebellion, knowing that His love will outlast and tenderly overcome our hate and hard-heartedness. He doesn't forgive us. He doesn't show grace or patience because of any quality that we exhibit. But He does it because His love is so great and so long-lasting and enduring that no matter how recalcitrant, no matter how stubborn, no matter how ignorant, no matter how much you dig in your heels, He can outweigh you. 1,000 ages in His sight are like a watch at the end of the night. And this is our inheritance. Aham bija pradapita. In the Bhagavad Gita, 14th chapter, 4th verse, Krishna says, Aham bija pradapita. Pita means father. I am the seed-giving father for all living beings. He is our creator. We are His children. As such, He seeks to pass on to us an inheritance. It's not an inheritance that we did anything to earn. When my mother passed away in 1995, the lawyer called me out. She said, your mother has left you $220,000. I was just floored. I wasn't the best son. She wasn't thrilled at the fact that I joined the Hare Krishnas. My whole family wanted to become a lawyer. She knew that if I got any money, it would go to the Hare Krishnas. And in fact, we spent the $220,000 here on the property. But the emotion that I felt when I got this call out of the blue from the lawyer, your mother left you $220,000, was like, I didn't deserve this. I didn't deserve this because I didn't fulfill her dreams for me. What I had expected was she would just cut me out of the will, you know, and that would have been perfectly reasonable. But she didn't, and neither does God either. He puts up with all of our waywardness, all of our aggression, lifetime after life, and He still seeks to give us an inheritance. And what is that inheritance? It's His strength. He wants to bestow His strength on us. And that strength will fuel us every minute of every day. He promises in the Bhagavad Gita, the Ramayana, and the Mahabharata, He promises renewal based on His strength, not on anything we do. He promises based on His strength, remission from loneliness. Based on His strength, freedom from bondage and liberation and loving association. That's what He wants to just bequeath to us. And all we have to do really is be willing to receive it. When Krishna had left the planet, this same Arjuna who went ahead to fight the battle of Kurukshetra and defeated all their soldiers, and even he defeated Indra, the king of heaven, and many demigods on different occasions. After Krishna left the planet, and Arjuna kind of, he kind of he fell into this meekness of bleakness, this weakness of bleakness, just for a moment. And he thought, Krishna's gone. My friend who fought with me, who advised me, who was my inseparable companion, he's left this mortal world, he's gone back to the spiritual world. And Arjuna was feeling bereft, you see. He was in a sort of, he'd gotten into a consciousness of duality, that Krishna is no longer with me. And again, thinking of him as latent rather than potential. So Arjuna became totally weakened. He lost all his vigor, his vitality. And while escorting Krishna's queens from the city of Krishna Dwarka to Hastinapur, on the way he was attacked by some ordinary highway robbermen and defeated. This same warrior who defeated demigods and great, great soldiers was defeated by some ordinary thieves and rogues on the side of the road. And he said, all my great power and strength has deserted me in the absence of Krishna. He complained in this way to his brother Yudhisthira. Yudhisthira said, Krishna hasn't deserted you. You have deserted Krishna. But Krishna never deserts you. You are thinking that Krishna is gone. And you've lost the strength. You've lost the connection. But it's the way of your thinking. Actually, Krishna is never apart from any of us. He is in the heart of every living being, directing the wanderings of all living beings. So Yudhisthira said, try something. Try chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And I'll bet you get your strength back. So Arjuna tried chanting Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Because God is omnipotent, and that means He's always present everywhere in the fullness of His power, even within each and every atom, within each and every one of our hearts. And that means that He is being absolute, non-different from His name. So when you chant His name, you associate directly with Him. And sure enough, as soon as Arjuna began to chant the name of the Lord and remember the many, many pastimes he'd shared with the Lord, he felt that the Lord, in fact, had never really deserted him. He had turned his back on the Lord. But our way of turning away from the shadows of bleakness and weakness and despair and turning to the light and regaining our strength, basking in that light, is chanting the holy names of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Krishna, Krishna, Hari, Hari. Hari Rama, 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 Hari, Hari. There's a maneuver in flying, if any of you have taken flying lessons, that at a certain point in your teaching, your instructor will make you intentionally put the plane into a tailspin. That's very scary. You get disoriented, you lose your balance, and the natural reflexive reaction is to turn away from the tailspin. Any of you who have been on ice have experienced the same thing. You want to turn away from the direction that you're going. That's what we would do naturally and reflexively. But the fact is, you need to turn into the spin and stabilize it, even while you're falling, even while the ground is approaching. You need to turn into the spin, stabilize it, and then go up. So you'll go much further down before you go up. But you will be able to recover. It's against all of our instincts. But if we rely not on our instincts, our reactions, and our training, we'll actually be able to pull ourselves out of the dive. So instinctually, we will react. Instinctively, we will seek revenge, retaliation, overreaction. But based on the training that we get through the chanting of the holy names and the reading of the scriptures and understanding how it is that we're meant to act differently from the reactive animals, we can learn how not to overreact. Booker T. Washington was a black scientist. He was a great intellect, a great scientist, in a time when blacks were regarded as hardly even human beings. They were regarded as hardly even human beings. There were scientists who would not even acknowledge that he was a human being, what to speak that he was on a level of or even superior to them as a scientist. So what is he going to do? What is he going to do? Everywhere he turns, he's treated like the water boy. So is he going to dissipate his energy, reacting in kind to everyone that insults him? Would he have achieved the greatness that he achieved if he had allowed other people's prejudices to control his life? This is what he said. I will never allow another man to control or ruin my life by making me hate him. When you say you make me mad, you are admitting that they are controlling your emotions. And we don't want to lose control. It's your choice. It's your choice. The moment that you start retaliating, the moment that you start seeking revenge, that you start trying to get even, you give up control of your life. You're reacting, you're not acting. And that is a position of weakness. Strength under control. A hot-tempered man stirs up strife, but he who is slow to anger quiets contention. He who is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his own spirit better than he who captures a city. Viktor Frankl writes this: they took my clothes. This is the Nazis. He was a Jewish person. But he wasn't a victim. You may say the Nazis victimized 6 million Jews. They victimized 6 million Jews. But Viktor Frankl, even though all this happened to him, he did not see himself as a victim. He said, you only become a victim if you give over control of your life to other people. So no one can make you a victim except you. Because you have control. You don't have control over what happens to you, but you do have control over how you react to it. So if you're a victim, don't blame anyone else. It was a choice that you made to react. This is what he said. They took my clothes, my wife, my kids, my wedding ring. I stood naked before the SS and realized that they can take everything in my life, but they cannot take away my freedom to choose how I respond to them. So there might have been 5,999,999 victims, but here was one person that wasn't a victim. Krishna himself shows this kind of forbearance in a story from the Puranas. The gods, the demigods, want to decide at one point in time, who is the greatest of the triumvirate, Brahma the creator, Vishnu the preserver, and Shiva the destroyer? Who is the greatest? And so they delegated Bhrigu Muni to go and to aggravate each one of them. And in seeing how they would react, they would determine which one was on the transcendental platform. So Bhrigu was specifically charged to go and be obnoxious to Brahma, Shiva, and Vishnu, and then see how they reacted. So he approached Brahma, who happened to be his father, and he failed to offer respects. In Vedic culture, you bow down and touch the feet of your father. He didn't do that. He made a mental offense. Within his mind, he omitted the proper offering of respects. And Lord Brahma got very, very angry. He got very, very angry. And he started cursing Bhrigu. Next, Bhrigu went to Lord Shiva. And the offense that he committed to Lord Shiva was more serious than the mental offense that he committed to Lord Brahma. He committed a verbal offense at Lord Shiva. Lord Shiva does penances and austerities. He's draped with snakes. And he lives often in the crematorium. And he was the brother of Bhrigu Muni. So when Bhrigu approached Lord Shiva, Lord Shiva came forward. Embrace me, my brother. I'm so glad to see you. And Bhrigu made a verbal insult. He said, really, I just had a shower. And, you can stay over there, I'll stay over here, we'll talk, you know. So Shiva carries his trident, and he was going to throw his trident at Bhrigu and kill him. He was extremely angry. So mental offense at Brahma, verbal offense, but the worst, most aggravating, aggressive behavior he saved for the last, Lord Vishnu. He performed a corporeal, a bodily offense. And when he came to Lord Vishnu, who was lying on Anantashesha, his feet being massaged by Lakshmi, the goddess of fortune, Bhrigu put his foot, snapped his foot right on the chest of Vishnu. And this is a grievous. In Vedic culture, the foot is the lowest part of the body. It's touching the ground and all kinds of dirty things. You never put your foot on anyone's upper body. It's the worst insult that you can give them. So, although Lord Vishnu received the most aggressive, the most provocative offense on the part of Bhrigu Muni, he did not allow himself to react. He was perfectly self-satisfied and perfectly self-contained within himself. This is what Lord Vishnu said to Bhrigu. Please purify me and my realm by giving the water that has washed your feet. This holy water is what makes all places of pilgrimage sacred. Today, my Lord, he's God, and he's describing the offender as his Lord, you see. Not only is he not trying to smash him and get even with him, he's reacting or treating him as his own Lord. I have now become the exclusive shelter of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi. She will consent to reside on my chest because your foot has rid it of all sins. And Bhrigu Muni was just like, wow. What strength. What meekness. How impressive is my Lord. And he went back and he reported to the demigods, it is Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna who is situate in the pure mode of transcendental goodness. He took the worst, a grievous offense, and he reacted not at all, with complete mildness. Of course, Lakshmi wasn't quite on the same level as the Lord, and because Bhrigu was a Brahmin, Lakshmi, ever since then, she makes Brahmins poor. She's the goddess of fortune. If you get rich, it's because of the favor of the goddess of fortune. So ever since then, she kind of has a little bit of a resentment. She had a response to what Bhrigu did, and she retaliated by making sure that all Brahmins ever since then are poor. Someone says, you know, this is all very good, but I can't control my emotions. I can't. I might as well try and control a tidal wave or a hurricane. I just cannot control my emotions. And that's true. There's a point at which even the strongest of us cannot control our emotion. So we need then to rely upon someone who can. And that is Vishnu, or that is Krishna. From last week's segment, we learned that Krishna could have blown out Indra for trying to inundate Vrindavan with rain, but he did not. He could have blown Bhrigu all the way across the universe for his offense, and no one would have blamed him, but he did not, because his is a power that's unlimited, it's patient, it shows grace, and it's controlled by love. And he himself is complete. Atmaramas Chamunaya. He doesn't need anything. He's completely self-satisfied and self-sufficient. There's no way you can insult him. There's no way he's going to take it personally. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, there's no work. That means there's no hurt. There's no pain. There's no aggression. There's no insult. You can be an atheist and get up and go on national TV and international and hire stadiums and talk about God is a foolish God and God's done a bad job and why does God allow this to happen or there is no God and I don't believe in God. And Krishna says, none of that affects me. You're not affecting me in the least. It's not like I'm going to come down and thump you with a lightning bolt or anything. It just doesn't affect me. We can glorify God. It doesn't make him any more. We can insult God. It doesn't make him any less. He's still God, perfect and complete and self-satisfied. And if we understand this truth about the Lord, then we also become free from reaction. We also do not overreact, nor do we become entangled in the fruit of reactions of work, which is called karma. So just give control to Krishna. We'll conclude with this. Even though you could blow them away, even though oftentimes it's within your power to blow them away, and you could do it and no one would blame you, still isn't it going to be a more relaxed, happy, stress-free mode of thinking to show patience, to show grace, roll with the punches, to not have things fluster you, even though you're in control and you could mete out tit for tat. But isn't it better, isn't it the high grounds to be in control of your emotions? We can be in control of the situation, but we can control our emotions and how we react to them. So that concludes our series, and we just review throughout the three-week series. We talked about how we need to be to those who serve us, understanding and not demanding. To those who disappoint us, we need to learn to be gentle and not judgmental. To those who disagree with us, we learn to be tender without surrender. To those who correct us, we need to learn to be teachable, not unreachable. And for those who hurt us, we need to learn how to be an actor and not a reactor. So with me. We conclude the series, if you will. Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.